Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll put context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, South Africa has a new prosecutions boss. What are his first priorities? Farming fights back as South African agriculture gears up for a stronger 2026. The used car market steadies as South African buyers stick with Volkswagen, Ford and Toyota. And luxury decoded as African consumers reshape what premium really means. It's Wednesday, the 7th of January.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
President Ramaphosa has moved to steady the leadership of South Africa's justice system by appointing advocate Andy Motibi, currently head of the Special Investigating Unit, as the country's new National Director of Public Prosecutions. It's a big job. The decision followed a high-profile advisory panel process in which none of the interviewed candidates were deemed suitable. And that, I think, underscores the challenges in filling this critical constitutional office. With me now is Lawson Naidu, Executive Secretary of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution. I want to discuss what this appointment means for prosecutorial independence and constitutional democracy in 2026. Lawson, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, what do we know about Advocate Motibi, and is this a good appointment in your opinion?
Thank you, Jeremy. Indeed, I think it's a very good appointment. I think Andy Motibi brings a wealth of experience from his tenure, not just at the SIU, but he's served in both the public and private sectors, having started his career as a prosecutor, served time as a magistrate. So he understands the criminal justice system as a whole. And in his role at the SIU, he's had to work very closely with other law enforcement agencies, such as the NPA, the Hawks, the Financial Intelligence Center, and so on. So he has a good understanding. He brings the kind of leadership skill set that I think is required at a critical but also complex organization like the NPA.
Let's talk about those leadership skills in just a moment and also what his priorities are. But interesting to note that the advisory panel, as I mentioned, found none of the interviewed candidates suitable. Surely, Lawson, that raises concern about the selection process itself.
Well, I think there are several concerns, one of which is that the process was rushed. The president only appointed that panel in October last year when he knew on the day that he appointed Shamila Bitoy 7 years ago that she would have to retire this month. It was left late. The panel was rushed. There was a limited period for nominations. There was a limited period for public comments on those nominations, even when the nomination period had been extended. And, you know, whilst one welcomes the open and competitive nature of the process, it's not been fully transparent. We only know the names of the six candidates who were shortlisted for interview. We don't know the other 26 who applied and why they were deemed not to be fit and proper for consideration. We have also not seen the report of the panel that deemed none of them suitable. But I think it was quite evident to those of us who watched those interviews that they all demonstrated shortcomings of one sort or another, which have rendered them, you know, not suitable to hold such a critical and important office. So I commend the panel for having taken the decision that they did not to make a recommendation. But I think the president also erred in that he could have referred the matter back to the panel and say, okay, I see your report, but here's another candidate who I think you should consider. Here's Advocate Andy Motibi, and go through the same process of a public interview with the kind of scrutiny that the other candidates went through. And I think that would have been a much better process to have followed.
Lawson Naidu, you talk about the challenges of leadership within a complex organization. What does that mean?
Well, the NPA is not an easy organization to run. It has devolved authority. We've got the directors of public prosecutions in each of the 9 provinces, in whom lies the responsibility to make prosecutorial decisions. You know, so you've got the 9 provinces, you've got a team of deputy national directors responsible for asset forfeiture, national prosecutions, corporate affairs, and so on. So it's a complex organization with, you know, over 3,500 prosecutors spread across the country. So it is an incredibly complex organization, and it needs somebody who has the kind of management experience at that high level, which I think Andy Motibi brings, and I don't think that any of the candidates who were interviewed adequately possessed.
What is his immediate priority?
Well, his immediate priority, I think, and you know, it's good that this appointment has come now, you know, even though it's probably later than it should have been, but it gives at least a short while for some kind of formal handover to take place between Shamila Batoi and Andy Mutebi. They've worked together before in the anti-corruption sphere of organs of state. So they know each other, and hopefully that handover will help Andy Mutebi to set his priorities for the period ahead. What are the challenges, the immediate challenges that the NPA faces? What needs to be done in order to properly secure the legislative amendments that would give proper autonomy over its operational and financial aspects of its work to the NPA and take it away from the Department of Justice? Because that will play a critical role in bringing in the kind of skills and capacity that is required in order to prosecute, in particular, complex commercial and corruption cases.
In that respect, are you confident that the Constitution provides adequate safeguards to ensure that the NDPP can act without fear or favour?
Well, I think that's been evident during the tenure of Shamila Batoi. You know, whatever her other weaknesses have been, I don't think there's been any evidence to suggest that there's been any attempt at improper influence over prosecutorial decisions. Maybe at lower levels, as we're hearing some evidence which I must stress has yet to be tested at the Madlanga Commission of complicity of prosecutors in some cases. But where those exist, they need to be rooted out, and that's going to be another issue that Mutebi is going to have to confront. Just a couple of days ago, the Minister of Justice called for lifestyle audits for prosecutors. That's something that I think is necessary in order to, you know, to deepen public confidence in the NPA as a whole. But that's going to come at a significant cost, and government is going to have to make those resources available for those lifestyle audits to be conducted.
And that fundamentally is the biggest problem. You alluded to the issue of funding, that the money has got to be found in order for this office to run effectively.
Indeed, you know, and we get commitments all the time from the president, the Minister of Justice, about the commitment to effectively tackling crime and corruption, but that requires dedicated resources, and that's where a serious discussions need to be had in terms of the kind of resourcing that the NPA is going to require, as well as the resourcing that other institutions within the law enforcement sector require, because we can't simply look at the NPA as a standalone institution. They rely to a large extent on the work done by SAPS, by Crime Intelligence, by the Hawks and others before cases can be brought before court.
And just a final one, and quickly, in the short to medium term, are there benchmarks that we should use to judge whether this appointment either strengthens or weakens the rule of law in South Africa?
Well, it's difficult to list those easily, but I think, you know, a big part of Mutebi's job is one, to restore, to continue the process of building staff morale within the NPA. There are many thousands of prosecutors who diligently go about their work every day. We've seen and heard about the conditions under which they operate. We've seen targeted assassinations and assassination attempts against prosecutors in some cases. So there are many, many challenges that Mutebi is going to face. But hopefully once he hits the ground, and he'll be able to take the nation into his confidence and set out what his immediate priorities are, and then we'll be able to measure him on that.
Lawson Naidoo, Executive Secretary of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, thank you very much indeed for that analysis.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
South Africa's agricultural sector is showing welcome signs of recovery after a tough drought and production setbacks, but the rebound in 2025 was uneven, with crop returns improving, livestock and disease pressures though continuing to weigh on the broader industry. So, as we look ahead to 2026 and food security, maybe better rainfall and brighter prospects could change the dynamics for farmers and markets, and obviously food security. I want to break all of this down with Wandile Sihlobo, who's Chief Economist at Agribusiness Chamber South Africa. Wandile, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's go back to 2025. How would you characterize the country's recovery in the agricultural sector? Broadly positive, or as I suggested, maybe a little more patchy than the headline suggested?
I would say, Jeremy, broadly positive. That's our 2025 to an extent that I think when the GDP figures come out, we continue to believe that agriculture probably last year expanded by plus 8%. But of course, when one zooms into the agricultural sector, and I think then the picture that you painted in your introductory remarks begins to be the reality, whereby you will see that this uptick is probably supported by some subsectors, while the major one, which is the livestock industry, is the one that has been under pressure. But if you think about grains, oilseeds, sugarcane, fruits, vegetable, wine production, we've seen excellent performance in 2025 on that. And Jeremy, that excellent performance of 2025 in those crop is building from a very difficult year, because remember, in 2024, we struggled with the midsummer drought and that heat wave in February 2024, which led to poor production. So last year we were recovering on that. So there's base effects, but also just generally good performance in crops and horticulture.
Wandile, let's look at livestock. What then is the main structural constraint, in your opinion, that is still holding that subsector back?
What has been the major challenge for the livestock in 2025 are perhaps two factors. One, when we started the year, the feed prices were fairly high, and they were fairly high because of the drought that I mentioned in 2024, which had led to a poor harvest here in SA, but more intensely in the region, to an extent that South Africa had to stabilize the maize supplies across the Southern Africa region, and that led to higher prices. It is only in the second half of the year where we started to see feed prices coming down to now where you and I are having this conversation in the new year, and maize prices in South Africa are down by plus 30% on a year-on-year basis. Last year at this time, this was a far region to believe. And the second aspect then, of course, is the issue of the animal diseases. And I think this is the most intense one. Just now in late December, I was driving around the Midlands area in KZN, talking to dairy farmers. When you see the situation there, you begin to see the impact it has been severe of the foot and mouth disease. So those are things that have weighed in the livestock or cattle farmers, to be specific, in 2025.
And a difficult one to call as far as foot and mouth is concerned. We don't really have a sense of what lies ahead this year, do we?
We don't have a sense of how things will turn out, but the very hope that we have in 2026 is that now we've been struggling with the foot and mouth disease for so long, to an extent that there was a policy change in South Africa around November or so 2025 to say, look, we have to explore then a broad vaccination of livestock in this country. And of course, that is a monumental task, Jeremy, because we have about 12.1 million cattle in this country. That's just the formal herd that we know of. It may happen that it's slightly more than that. So vaccinating all of those cattle, one, the logistics of doing that is a difficult one. Most importantly, though, sourcing the vaccine, because remember, in some of our conversation, I've made the point that the Agricultural Research Council, OBP, which were the state-owned entities that used to produce vaccines for South Africa, they are no longer fit. They fell victim of the state capture, and we were never quick enough on making sure that we revamp them. Now, South Africa cannot produce the foot and mouth disease vaccine. We are relying on Botswana, and our sense at AgBiz is that we need to import also from the likes of Turkey, and we hear that. If you think about the Turkey vaccines, they last much more. They are more potent rather than compared to what you get from Botswana. And lastly, the fact that private sector must come in play. You can't only be consulting with private sector in terms of policy, but I think those that have capabilities to produce the vaccines, they must be provided the licenses to do that so that we have the supply and we can get this done.
Wandile, broadly, the sector's risk profile is improving, but is it improving enough, do you think, to attract investment into things like irrigation, supply chain, and even value-added processing?
Absolutely, Jeremy, because I'm starting now with the highlighting all of these negatives that have to do with the foot and mouth disease. But I mean, in reality, if we think about where this sector is today, how we are thinking about 2026, we hold a much more optimistic view. The rain that we've been receiving since last year has done enormous improvement in terms of grazing felt for the livestock industry. So that's the positive too, in supporting the crop production and making sure that even those that are in fruit, they're going to do well. I mean, we're already getting now signals from the wine producers in this country saying, look, we are going to have a bigger wine harvest, but not only just bigger, but the quality will be great. And that's the same sentiment that we are receiving from people that are in the field crops, grains, oilseeds, sugarcane, similarly in the fruit side. So yes, the challenges are there, but the profile of the sector in terms of growth is positive. And then that means then even on attracting investment, there remains plenty of opportunities in the sector. And I think some people continue to participate in it.
Which I guess would then beg the question, are South African farmers positioned well enough to capitalize on global demand should it start to increase?
I think they are. I mean, and this has been our path for since 1994. We now, Jeremy, sitting at the point whereby we are exporting about half of what we produce. And if you think back in year 2000, we were exporting about $2 billion worth of agricultural products. Our sense is that for 2025, our exports, Jeremy, would have crossed for the first time a $14 billion mark in terms of the export. So just tells you then us taking advantage of that global demand. And the most interesting thing about this export prospect is that we are not only just going into a particular single market. We are big in the African continent, but also massive in Europe and expanding more in Asia and the Middle East. And there remains greater possibilities on expansion in the Middle East and Asia, while of course we have to now 2026 work more on making sure that we preserve our presence in the Americas and all of these other markets that where we already have a solid footprint. So South African farmers are taking advantage of the global demand and are quite competitive in doing that.
And that's the overview for 2026. My thanks to Wandile Sihlobo, Chief Economist at Agribusiness Chamber South Africa. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's used car market, I think, is telling a very different story to the new car showroom. While new brands are flooding into the country, second-hand buyers are still voting firmly for familiarity, reliability, and resale value. And all of that obviously makes sense. The question is what this says about risk, affordability, and broader trust in the wider auto industry. And I want to discuss the trends now shaping used car demand. And I'm in conversation with Errol Levine, who's Chief Executive Officer of Wheelie. Errol, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with this. Why does brand trust matter more in the previously owned market than new car buying?
Thank you for the call, Jeremy. Well, what we've seen on our side here, brand trust is crucial. A lot of older generation still have the belief in VWs and Toyotas, the traditional brands, and they want to have a reliable vehicle that's affordable, and they can ensure that they can still run the vehicle for a longer term and have the financial impact not later if something breaks down.
Is that brand trust, though, Errol, in danger of eroding at any point, given that a lot of the Asian marques that we're seeing coming into the country are getting better in terms of reliability and quality?
So I think the Asian brands are fantastic. I don't think there is a bad vehicle out there. So what we've seen in our stats, we've seen that the older generation are still very brand loyal to the traditional brands. But the younger generation, we've seen a complete shift. The younger generation isn't too worried about the brand, a VW or Toyota or any of the mainstream brands. They're actually interested in tech and value for money. Where I've seen the shift happen on our side is more the technology and value for money, and the younger generation aren't always going towards the traditional mainstream brands. So similar to the same concept when the Koreans came in with Hyundai and Kia. They were a little bit small in the beginning, and then the brand trust started growing, but the vehicles are fantastic. I think the shift will happen, and I've seen a huge increase in sales in the Chinese market. So I think this year is going to be an exciting market to see the used car market for the Chinese brand expand at a rapid pace.
Which I guess raises the question why the surge of new brands that you talk about isn't translating quickly into confidence in that pre-owned space just yet.
So like with anything new, People need to take a bit of time to understand what's happening in the market. Is there parts availability? Is there servicing there? Is there reliability? Some of the brands have been around for a long time with the Chinese, but what we've seen, the reliability is great. I mean, they've got massive warranties on the vehicles. So I think that is going to have a mind shift very shortly. As I said, the younger generation has already moved across to the Chinese brands. And I think a lot of other people also downgrading from the traditional German brands and going inside Chinese brands.
When it comes to purchasing a vehicle, how important then is after-sales infrastructure when it comes to determining long-term resale value?
So this is crucial. So obviously, when you're purchasing a vehicle, you want to make sure that there are OEMs available out there and dealerships to support the vehicle. If the vehicle does need a service or there are parts that do fail, you need to make sure that there is at least a sufficient infrastructure out there to make sure that you can fix your vehicle. So it looks like on our side, the data is showing that they are expanding at a rapid pace and they do have a massive footprint countrywide.
Errol, hatchbacks, I read, still dominate used sales. Why is that? Is it a cost of living story or maybe just a story around mobility?
So I think it just comes down to affordability. So people obviously are very financially strapped currently. I know the interest rates have been decreasing, but I still think we have to wait a little bit longer to see that impact affect the consumer. So the consumer's looking for something small, reliable. We see a lot of consumers downgrading from larger vehicles into compact hatchback vehicles. But the SUV market is still very strong. But everyone wants a small, get-around car.
What do you think is missing in South Africa's product mix right now?
In the product mix, I think it comes more down to the financing options. I see that we slowly are adapting to similar to international trends, where it comes down to leasing a vehicle instead of trying to finance a vehicle. So more like a rent-to-buy option. This is slowly expanding in the market, and it's probably the better way to purchase a vehicle. There's no risk for you. You replace a vehicle after a period, and you just pay the installments. So as you know, a vehicle is a depreciating asset. So to be paying off something like that at the end of the term, you usually do not get money out the vehicle. You usually settle the vehicle and purchase a new vehicle.
Errol, let me pick you up on depreciation. How much does that influence buying decisions compared to maybe features and technology?
I think when purchasing a vehicle, I don't think the consumer is looking at depreciation, especially in the bracket that we're playing in. The bracket's probably anywhere between 200,000 to 300,000 rand vehicles. I think depreciation has more of an impact on the high value vehicles. And every vehicle depreciates unless you get a very popular model. So the Suzukis are doing unbelievably well. Toyota's a normal traditional brand. So I don't think depreciation has an impact on a consumer when they purchase a vehicle. They just want to know that it's reliable and cost effective.
You mentioned the popularity of hatchbacks. What about SUVs, particularly the compact SUVs? They're starting to filter into the used market. Do you think we're reaching a point where they might start disrupting the pattern?
100% agree with you. The likes of the Chery Tigos, unbelievable vehicle, small little hatchback. Those cars are actually dominating it. It was the Kia Sportage and the Hyundai Tucson's, but just the pricing on the Chinese are there, and I see we're going to have a real impact. Traditionally, South African buyers are always looking for SUVs, and the smaller SUVs, I think, are going to have a massive impact in 2026.
Looking ahead, Errol, what do you think needs to change industry-wide for newer brands then to be more trusted second-hand, if you understand the question?
So I don't think there's much that the newer brands can adapt and change. I think this comes down with long-term strategies. This is service offering, reliability in the vehicles, especially parts supply. As soon as it gives it a bit of time, as I mentioned previously, the Korean brands, when they entered the market, a lot of people were skeptical. And it just takes time for people to understand that it is a reliable brand. The vehicles all across all models and makes are extremely reliable. So I think time is just going to give the test, yes. So we're going to see in a couple of months or a couple of years here, we're going to see that the vehicles are reliable and this is going to grow their footprint if they keep their service levels up.
And just a final question, conversation happening at the start of 2026. What's the general sense from your perspective as to how the auto industry is going to play out this year? Is it going to be another tough year or are you a little bit more optimistic given that we're also seeing a stronger rand?
Hard to call. Last year was up and down. Some months were phenomenal. I see 2026, if we get a couple of more interest rate cuts on our side, it's going to be more buoyant. One thing about our country, there is no infrastructure for public transport, so there's always going to be a demand for vehicles, especially used cars. So it's priced well. The new cars pricing are extremely high, and I think the used cars are going to be flourishing in 2026.
Errol Levine, Chief Executive Officer at Wheelie, thank you very much indeed for your time. I appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, luxury debates often frame African consumers as behind global taste trends, mistaking visibility for insecurity and restraint for refinement. But what if loud and quiet luxury are not opposites at all, but just rational responses to very different histories and social realities? It's an interesting issue. And to discuss why African consumption is frequently misread and what global brands keep getting wrong, I'm joined now by Ray Langer, who's Group Chief Executive of the agency Lagos Delaney South Africa. Ray, a very warm welcome to you. Why is visible luxury then so often mislabeled as unsophisticated?
Firstly, good afternoon, Jeremy, and to all your listeners. It's really just about context, and what I wanted to get across with this piece is just it's about what success needs to do in different societies. And I think what's happened specifically on the African continent is that it's the success, and in terms of how you show up from a luxury perspective, has been labeled from a different context and a different environment, and predominantly across the EU. So it's really about understanding what is that luxury element in across our continent, and what does that mean for people that come from this type of environment?
What's the consequence of that misunderstanding of the context, then, particularly for brands?
So really, when it comes into it for brands, is that it's not a one size fits all. And what I mean by that is you can't have I'll speak from an advertising perspective, you can't have a campaign that launches in Paris that appeals to that type of culture and think that you can copy paste that and put that in on the African continent and feel that that will yield the same results. It's, I think what we need to do a lot more, is, especially from a brand's perspective, is understand the culture of the environment that you're trying to play in, and start gain a better understanding of the type of consumer that is in that environment, and how do you appeal to them, not because something worked in your environment in Europe or the Americas or the likes thereof, but rather what do people here on our continent strive for, what appeals to them, and what do they care about, and then I think you'll be in a way better position to leverage a lot more of the consumers here.
But how do brands go about redesigning without losing either their core brand philosophy or the aspirational impact that so many consumers want?
So there's no single luxury playbook. And then that's what I mentioned around just the strategies. I think we have to have a broader look now as to what type of strategies that do you need to go into this environment, and how do you go about approaching that, you know? So I think that that's very important for us. And basically, what it could be is having a look at your strategies, and then saying to yourself, okay, our strategy works over here in this environment. Can we now relook at our strategies and see what are the opportunities in terms of how we can show up in a new environment? If you're wanting to crack the African market, what's very, very important is you now need to look at how do consumers behave. You've got the playbook in terms of how they behave in your current market, where you're doing really, really well. If you're wanting to go to a new market, you have to take the time, and you have to take the understanding and invest the money in understanding the market and figuring out how do we best integrate ourselves there so we can get the success. But the success is definitely not going to happen over time. It's going to take a little bit of time. But if you're willing to be in that market, you have to invest accordingly.
And which brands are doing that right, do you think?
Unfortunately, not my favorite, but a lot of the liquor brands are. It is a problem that we have across our continent, but a lot of the alcohol brands are. A brand like Guinness is doing extremely well across the African continent, and a lot of the telecommunication companies. So our very own MTN is thriving a lot, obviously in sub-Saharan Africa and in the northern parts of Africa. But what we've yet to see is a big influx of the traditional European American brands coming into the market and really doing well. A lot of them have tried. Like, you look at some of the brands like Starbucks that have come into South Africa and the likes thereof, but a lot of them have tried. But I think they have to realize very quickly that what works on their side of the market is not necessarily going to work in our market.
Ray, you also talk about something called loud luxury. What is it? And is it about insecurity or the kind of legitimizing of success?
It's definitely not about insecurity or overcompensation. Where the interpretation comes from is just judging African behavior through a European lens. I think we've constantly been looked at and said, what works in my market, why is it happening like that in Africa? And I think that that's a huge misconception. So what's really important is that visibility in Africa it's often testimony, and it's not about insecurity. So if you're in Zurich, for lack of a better example, and you have a beautiful luxury watch, the whole thing is I belong. Where in Johannesburg or Lagos, it often means we've made it, you know, and that difference really matters. So it's really just about understanding the environment that we're in and understanding that a lot of people, specifically on the African continent, had different starting blocks to a lot of the wealthy people that live in in Europe and the Americas. So it's about a lot of the first, I mean, we're only starting to see truly the second generation of wealth coming through, specifically around non-white people in South Africa specifically. So I think that there's a fantastic opportunity now for potentially the next generation, there'll be an opportunity for I belong. But I think where we get it wrong is a lot of the times is we say that we're behind the other countries, but I don't think we are behind. I think we're just on a completely different journey, and we have to embrace that journey, and brands need to embrace that journey as well and realize that this is a different place, and now how do I crack it and how do I gain leverage in this type of environment?
And how far down the line do you think we are then in terms of brands and consumers, for that matter, actually defining their own codes?
I think we are moving in the right direction. There are a lot of brands, and I think a lot of people are very actively trying to invest in the African continent, which is really promising for us. I think there's been a lot of negativity in the past about just the risk and the lack of information that is available across the African continent. There's a lot of brands like Nielsen that are starting to get a lot more data, because a lot of data is not, I don't want to say it's falsified, but there's just so many people, and I don't think there's been enough effort yet to go and gather as much data as we actually could. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we could see an extremely positive, radical shift on the African continent. And I think what that will also do is, where we are currently, we have a lot of our extremely talented Africans leaving the continent for better opportunities. I think we're going to see a slight change in direction, with a lot of the Africans staying here because there'll be more opportunities on our continent than abroad.
Just a quick one, and I absolutely acknowledge that there's no one playbook that fits all, as you've said, but is there anything specific that brands need to change if they want authentic growth on the continent, authentic and sustainable growth?
Well, I think the most important thing for me is just realizing that luxury doesn't signal the same thing everywhere. And the brands that understand that and really accept that are the ones that are going to shape the future of this category. And I think if you go into the market and take the time to invest in a market and get to learn about the people in the market, that is the best way, because where a lot of these quote unquote luxury brands developed themselves were in a specific market, and they worked really well for that, right? And now if you're wanting to go into a brand new market and drive for new sustainability and growth, then you have to understand where you're playing. So my advice to any brands is get out there, get into the market, but be open and willing to understand that the things that you have worked for you in the past may necessarily not work right now. So if you're wanting to take that journey, then invest in the people and invest in the environment that you want to play in.
Ray Langer, thank you very much indeed. Group Chief Executive of the agency Lagos Delaney South Africa. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.